If you're invested in the future of our major aquatic habitats, I mean, think about places like the Chesapeake Bay, those critical tidal zones. You know, we've been throwing money at this problem for decades.
Billions of
Right,
dollars.
billions. Upgrading wastewater plants, planting all those underwater grasses, building massive oyster reefs, and yet real, meaningful progress. It just feels agonizingly slow sometimes.
Well, it's a fundamental mismatch, you know. We're trying to restore these very sophisticated natural systems, systems that need a high baseline of water, clarity, and cleanliness in an environment that is now, well, fundamentally broken. And our sources for this deep dive, specifically the prospectus for Project Pearl, they point to a huge stressor that is just so often overlooked.
And that's microplastic contamination.
That's it. It's often dismissed as, you know, a secondary issue. It's not.
Okay, let's unpack this right away because the data we're looking at here is
Yeah.
it's genuinely alarming. We're doing a deep dive today into the tech behind Project Pearl. That's proactive engineering for aquatic rehabilitation and legacy.
It's quite a name.
It is, but it's basically designed to fill this massive critical gap right at the water's edge.
And the problem isn't just, you know, the plastic bags or bottles you can see.
It's the invisible stuff.
Exactly. It's the invisible particulate matter. The sources are showing that in urban tidal waters, microplastics now make up a staggering 15 to 30% of all suspended solids.
Wait, 15 to 30%. That's not a choice pollutant.
No. That's a massive, pervasive particulate burden that's just clogging the entire ecosystem.
And here's the finding that, for me, completely reframes the problem. This is what makes an intervention like Pearl so necessary. The concentrations of these particles. They're 10 to 100 times higher right where the water meets the land.
At the shoreline interface.
Why there? Why that last, say, 50 meters?
It's just physics and hydrodynamics. You have tidal flows, you have currents hitting built infrastructure, and the buoyancy of these tiny little particles, it just traps them.
So they're not dispersing.
No, instead of being spread out across the entire bay, they're forced to accumulate in that critical nearshore zone. It becomes the ultimate environmental stress zone.
So if its shoreline is the bottleneck, what does that mean for all the billions we've already spent on those, traditional restoration projects?
It's a disaster, frankly. You have to understand why these plastics are such a problem. It's not just their physical presence. What's fascinating here is that microplastics, they act like mobile sponges.
Mobile sponges.
Yes, they're chemically powerful attractors. They absorb and concentrate other contaminants, nutrients, heavy metals, PFAS, bacteria,
So they're soaking it all up.
and they hold these things at levels that are 100 to 1,000 times higher than the water around them.
Why? So we're not just dealing with little inert bits of plastic. We're talking about tiny, moving contamination hotspots.
That's exactly right. They're constantly cycling toxins back into the ecosystem. Think about submerged aquatic vegetation or SAV.
Eelgrass,
Yeah.
things like that.
Exactly. Eelgrass. The number one reason SAV isn't recovering globally is light penetration. They need sunlight to grow.
Of course.
So if you have microplastics loaded with dark organic carbon, clouding the water at these incredibly high concentrations right where those grasses are trying to grow, they can't survive. They can't photosynthesize.
And I assume the same goes for oysters, which are supposed to be nature's great water filters.
Yes, oyster restoration depends on them filter feeding, but when the water quality is this bad, the oysters spend more time just resting or spitting out material they can't eat.
So they become less efficient.
Much less efficient.
Yeah.
And worse, the plastic particles themselves can impair their reproduction. We are asking natural systems to clean water that is already way too contaminated for them to even function.
Okay, so this is the core of it. If you don't treat the water at that point of maximum concentration, the shoreline, all the downstream efforts, the oyster reefs, the planted grasses, they're basically set up to fail.
They're fighting an impossible battle. And that's the unmet need the Pearl Prospectus is designed to address. The market just lacks a modular, scalable shoreline treatment system.
Right, you either have the massive wastewater plant way upstream or these low-impact ponds that need huge amounts of land and don't even target microplastics.
Exactly.
So let's look at the intervention. How does Pearl actually propose to fix this bottleneck? What's the architecture look like?
Well, it's all designed around flexibility. It's a modular, multi-stage platform that can be deployed in two main configurations.
Okay, first up is the vessel-mounted platform.
This is the primary workhorse. It's ideal for brackish, estuarine places like the Chesapeake Bay. It's mobile, you can reposition it, and crucially, you don't have to buy any land.
Which is a huge barrier.
A massive barrier. You can move it to different restoration hotspots or park it in tidal creeks and marinas where you know those concentrations are peaking.
And the second one, the fixed dockside system. That sounds more permanent.
It is. Think of a municipal storm sewer outfall, an MS4 pipe, that's draining stormwater right into a harbor. Or maybe an industrial site with a known contamination plume, like a PFAS hotspot. The dockside system just locks right in.
Okay, now for the really fascinating part. The engineered treatment train. How does this thing actually work? How does it handle everything from the plastic bits down to the invisible chemicals?
It's a staged approach, and the sequence is key. The first step is purely mechanical. It's a robust screening system that gets at least a 90% capture rate of microplastics, 50 micrometers and larger.
So right away, the bulk of the physical plastic is just gone.
Gone. That immediately removes the biggest part of the particulate stress.
Okay, so what's next? What happens to the nutrients and chemicals that plastic was carrying?
So then we move into the chemical and adsorption stages, which can be customized for the site. The first filter media is often zeolite.
And why zeolite?
Because it's incredibly good at high ammonium removal. We're talking rates between 75 and 95%. And ammonium is usually the most toxic form of nitrogen in a discharge, especially for delicate juvenile aquatic life. You have to remove it first.
That makes perfect sense. Get rid of the immediate toxicity. Then what?
Next is a stage of magnesium-doped biochar. You should think of the stage as like a pre-scrubber.
Okay.
It's targeting general dissolved organic carbon, other organics, removing 40 to 60%. And this step is so critical because those organics can foul up or interfere with the more specialized media that comes next. The biochar protects it.
I see. So it's kind of like cleaning the dishes before you stick them in the high-efficiency specialized dishwasher.
That's a great way to put it. You're protecting the really high-value, expensive media.
What is that final chemical stage?
That's where we get the big nutrient culprits. Nitrogen and phosphorus. They use specialized ion exchange resins. One for nitrate, getting 90 to 97% removal, and a different one for phosphate, with an impressive 90 to 99% removal.
Those numbers are incredible.
They are. When you add it all up, the system is delivering nutrient reductions that are often double or triple what traditional land-based engineering can do.
And here is where it gets really interesting for me, especially for these estuary deployments. The prospectus talks about an optional high-value stage, the living oyster biofilter.
This is the genius of the system. It's integrating biology for that final polish.
So you're putting oysters right on the unit.
In saltwater deployments, yes. They serve as a biological finishing touch. They give you an additional 20 to 30% reduction in total suspended solids, and they help aggregate any leftover microplastics into little biodeposits that are easier to manage.
So this isn't just an engineering box. It's actively seeding a cleaner ecosystem right there. You're creating the clean water, and then letting nature's own filters thrive in those new conditions.
It's ecological preconditioning. That's the term. You create the necessary baseline water quality first. You remove the overwhelming stress, and that allows the natural restoration processes, the native oysters, the SAV recovery, to actually succeed.
Okay, let's shift from the pipes and pumps to the pixels and profits. Because Pearl isn't just a cleaning device. The prospectus is very clear. It's an environmental intelligence platform. What does that mean for the business model?
It creates this really crucial dual revenue model. Stream one is pretty straightforward. Treatment services, you're selling compliance and cleanup.
To cities, to industry.
Exactly. But stream two, that's the future of environmental management.
Which is data set as a service.
Yes. Every single Pearl unit is also a high frequency monitoring node. I mean, we are talking about generating data that the environmental sector desperately needs but really struggles to collect right now.
What kind of data are we talking about here? And who pays for it?
Each system has 8 specific data collection points, DPs, from the raw water intake all the way to the final clean effluent. It captures data on turbidity, microplastic removal, nutrient transformation, stage by stage.
So you can see exactly how well each filter is working in real time.
In real time. Regulators pay for that verification. Researchers pay to model contamination plumes. Insurers pay to quantify and mitigate environmental risk. This granular, real-time accountability is gold.
Let's run through a couple of real-world scenarios. First, MS4 compliance for cities. their big stormwater runoff headache.
Right. Municipalities are facing just escalating costs, especially with things like the Chesapeake Bay TMDL requirements. Their traditional solutions, building wetlands, bioretention systems, they demand massive amounts of land.
And land in urban areas like Baltimore or DC is incredibly expensive or just not available.
Exactly. And those systems deliver lower nutrient removal rates, maybe 40 to 60% for nitrogen. Pearl is an elegant bypass. You put the dockside system at the outfall, and suddenly you have a verified, space-efficient solution that also generates valuable nutrient credits.
With much higher removal rates.
Significantly higher. 80 to 95% for total nitrogen, 85 to 95% for phosphorus, and the 8 data points provide the undeniable proof that regulators are now demanding.
Okay, second scenario, PFAS compliance. This feels incredibly timely with the new EPA standards, getting down to 4 parts per trillion. That's an urgent problem for airports, military bases.
Anywhere AFFF, that firefighting foam, was used, the compliance pressure is intense and the cleanup is notoriously extensive. Pearl's fixed installation uses a specialized PFAS selective resin that gets 95 to 99% removal. But the huge economic breakthrough isn't just the removal rate.
It's the disposal costs, right?
Yeah.
With things like carbon filters, you have to pay a fortune to get rid of the contaminated media once it's saturated.
That is the core challenge. Pearl's system has regenerable media. You use a simple saltwater brine flush to regenerate the resin on-site.
So you're not constantly buying new media and paying to haul the old stuff away.
Exactly. It drastically reduces operating expenses and waste liability. It makes the whole thing economically viable long-term, which is where other methods really struggle.
And that biochar stage we talked about earlier, that proves its value again here.
Absolutely. The biochar pretreatment makes sure general organics are gone so they don't clog up the expensive PFAS resin. It protects the most valuable part of the process. It's a fully optimized treatment train.
So what does this all mean? We started with this silent killer of restoration, these microplastics acting like contaminant sponges at the shoreline. And we've walked through a solution that's engineered, biologically supportive, and built on high-resolution data.
It really is designed to be a foundational infrastructure layer. It's the only shoreline deployable tech that's tackling microplastics, nutrients, and emerging contaminants like PFAS all at the same time. By focusing on that ecological preconditioning, fixing the water first, it gives the bigger natural restoration projects a real chance to succeed.
That dual focus on treatment and data is what makes it so much more than just a filter. It's interesting, the sources even hint this is just the beginning. They say the system is built with quantum-ready architecture and integrates external data from places like USGS and NOAA.
Right, to create watershed-scale intelligence. And this raises a really important question for you to think about as you look at the future of infrastructure. If this technology moves beyond just localized cleanup and establishes a foundational, high-frequency environmental data network.
A system with real-time, stage-by-stage accountability.
For every drop of water, how quickly could that transform all major water restoration projects globally? Could this new model of networked, modular, floating infrastructure effectively force the retirement of our current, less data-driven and lower-performing solutions?